room, all of them big, all of them heavily armed, and all of them with a kind of grizzled faces that looked like they'd been run over by a brigade of cuirassiers. One stood by the window, one leaned against the wall, and one reclined on her bed, grinning at her in what he must have thought was a friendly manner. Laura took them all in sourly. Her saddlebag sat next to the bed, so this wasn't the wrong room. "I paid for clean linens, asshole," she told the one on the bed. The man's grin faded, and he stood up, crossing the small room to tower above her.
"What's your name?"
he demanded. Laura looked up at him and resisted the urge to cut his throat. People didn't loom like that unless they were trying to intimidate, and her height meant she had to deal with confident, tall idiots all the time. She could kill all three of them before they could draw their swords, but now was not the time or the place.
"Can I help you, gentlemen, with something?"
"Berkov, Dorna," the man by the wall said. Dorna, Vlora noted, was a Brudanian name. The man continued.
"We were told a pair of mercenaries had checked into the hotel this afternoon and were unaware of the circumstances surrounding the, local politics."
The last two words made Vlora want to punch him really hard. Instead, she forced a smile on her face.
"And what are you doing in my room?"
"Recruiting,"
the one called Dorna said in a deep growl.
"You're unaligned, and nobody in this town with a sword is allowed to be unaligned."
"And which of these clubs do you idiots belong to?"
Vlora asked. She leaned back against the door, slumping casually, her hands within easy reach of both her weapons. Dorna drew himself up.
"We're Jezzy's shovels, and if you know what's good for you, you'll sign up with us tonight."
"What Dorna means," the man leaning on the wall said, "is that Jezzy pays the best, and she's not a greasy pillow. We'll pay 100 a week for your sword, and we'll give you a place to bunk."
Laura pretended to consider.
"Not interested," she finally said.
Dorna loomed closer.
"Excuse me."
"I said I'm not interested. I came up here for some easy work guarding a mine or a caravan. This city is hot as a powder barrel over a fire, and I'm not interested in getting into some stupid turf war."
"Listen, bitch," Dorna growled. "You're either with us or against us. You can..."
Flora's palm hit him beneath the chin, snapping his neck back and spraying her face with blood. He stumbled back, crimson pouring out of his mouth. He spat half his tongue onto the floor and immediately began to scream, pawing at his face. The man by the window rounded the bed, drawing a cudgel, but even without a powder trance, Vlora was faster. She punched him hard in the gut, doubling him over, then slammed his head against the wall hard enough to put him out cold. In the same motion, she drew her pistol, pointing it at the man leaning against the wall. His hand fell away from his sword.
"You tell your boss," Vlora said, "that I'm not interested in playing in a turf war. I don't give a shit about your sides, and I'd like to be left alone until I see fit to check out of this fine establishment. Is that civilized enough for you?"
The man raised his hands, palms out.
"I get it. I get it." "You were polite, so I'm not going to smash your face in. Take your arsehole friends and get out."
The man pushed his now tongueless companion out the door, leaving so quickly that they forgot their third member lying unconscious on the floor. Laura stared down at the prone figure and sighed, putting a pistol back in her belt. She reached down and took him by the hair, dragging him out the door and down the hall, then down the stairs, while the entire great hall watched in silence. Taniel sat in the corner, head in his hands, while Vlora dragged the body up to the manager's podium. The squirrely little man stared at her, eyes wide.
Is there something I can do for you, Mom? He stuttered.
You can leave this guy somewhere until he wakes up, Laura said. He shouldn't be out more than a minute or two. Send someone up to my room with fresh linens and to clean the blood and the bit of tongue off my floor. Laura took a handkerchief out of her pocket and wiped the red spatter off her face.
Did you say tongue?
I did. And if you be so kind as to not sell my comings and goings to the town big bosses, I'll be kind enough not to feed you your own toes. Good night.
Chapter 22 Stike pored over a map by the light of a single oil lantern, while the camp around him settled into the silence of an army at rest. They were several miles north of Granalia, and he'd finally gotten the chance to wash the blood from his skin and clothes, but the Dragonman ambush was still fresh in his mind. If the Mad Lancers had not arrived, those Dragonmen would have killed him, Selene, and Carpole, no matter how hard he fought. While he'd never particularly feared death, he knew from experience that Dragonmen had no problem with harming children. And the idea that they would murder Selene without a second thought made him sick to his stomach. It was a disquieting feeling, fueling an indignant rage that kept him from being able to sleep. The flaps of his tent were thrown back, breaking him out of his meditation, and Ibana's face appeared in the opening.
"Have a minute," she asked.
Stike joined her by the coals of the fire, map still in hand.
"You should sleep," he said.
"Too much to do. You?"
"Harder to sleep since the labor camps."
Stike tapped one finger on the back of his lancer's ring and changed the subject.
"How did your ride go? Doesn't look like you saw any action."
It was the first time they'd had a chance to talk since their arrival had saved him from the Dragonmen, and he needed to catch up.
"We didn't," Ibana confirmed. "We saw three armies. Two for Trastan and one Dionys, and a dozen scouting parties. But we managed to steer clear of any trouble. One thing of note, Lindit's armies are stripping the land. Every town between here and Landfall that hasn't been looted by the Dionys is being hit by the Fitrastans. They're taking harvests, emptying granaries, stealing wagons, weapons and animals. Anything of use to the war effort is being swept up."
"Conscription?"
"Everyone healthy between 14 and 60.
"Pit!"
Stike didn't like the idea of conscription. Forcing someone to fight didn't make them a warrior. But beyond his personal ideals, the fact that Lindert had already turned to conscription meant that she was worried about this war.
"Next time you see soldiers stealing from Fitrastan citizens, string 'em up."
Ibana's eyebrows rose.
"What's the point in fighting for people who were starved before winter?"
Ibana responded, "Lindit would argue that every resource left behind is one the Dionys will snatch up."
"Then Lindit damn well needs to guard her citizens better."
Stike had a small sense of understanding. The Dionys landing all along the coast meant Lindit had to pick her battles. This was as bad or worse than the revolution. But that didn't make it right.
"You're recruiting?"
"Anyone who's strong enough to ride and hold a lance."
"They know what we're really up to."
"They know that they'll be left behind if they don't follow orders. We added about 150 to our numbers since you left to deal with Tenny Wiles."
"Good enough, I suppose," Stike said.
Ibana watched him sidelong.
"How did that go, by the way?"
"It went well."
Ibana opened her mouth as if to ask further, but something in Stike's tone must have warned her away. She took the map, rolling it out on her lap.
"We've got some news from our scouts."
"Yeah."
She paused, looking Stike in the eye.
"Do you really believe Jackal and his muttering about spirits?"
"What does that have to do with our scouts?"
"Just answer the question."
"I have more evidence to believe him than not," Stike replied.
"Well, I don't. It's a lot of horse shit."
"Then why do you ask?"
She hesitated again, clearly frustrated.
"Because he was right."
She drew her finger along the map. "The coasts are in flames. Every major city and most of the small ones are either captured or under siege. Little Starland is definitely gone, just like Jackal told us a week ago. Swinshire is captured, too."
"Shit," Stike said.
Swinshire was on one of two major routes from the center of Fatrasta out onto the sliver of land on the west coast they called the Hammer. They'd planned on swinging through Swinshire to pick up news, a day of rest, some recruitment, and a major resupply before their final push toward whatever awaited them near the Godstone. That meant they had one option left, Belport, and Stike wasn't sure he was ready for that. Valayain, the third of the men who'd betrayed him to Videlis Jess, was rumoured to be in Belport. Since letting Tenny Wiles go, Stike had wanted more time to consider his actions before another confrontation.
"Belport it is, then," he said.
"Belport it is," Ibana agreed, rolling up the map.
"You figure out what you want to do about those dragon men."
Stike cursed them under his breath. Their mere presence complicated things, let alone the fact that they wanted to kill him.
"Did you triple the size of our scouting patrols?"
"I did, but no one has seen hide nor hair of them since they fled Grenalia."
Stike remembered the dragon man in Landfall. He'd been an arrogant prick, acting like he could take on an army and win. Stike had now seen two of them fight, and his victories had come from brute force that few could match. He had no doubt that four dragon men, if they were so inclined, could make life miserable for the Lancers. But would they? They'd taken great pains to come after him when he was isolated. Perhaps they didn't want the risk of fighting a whole army.
"Not much we can do until they show their faces again," Stike said.
"Drill the men and make sure they know exactly what we're dealing with. I don't need dozens dead because they underestimate the enemy. With any luck, they'll keep their distance when we reach Belport."
Stike ran a hand through his hair, listening to Celine snoring in the next tent over.
"Drill the men for an extra hour tomorrow. You're still using the buddy system?"
"It's working pretty well, I think," Ibana answered.
"Good. I'm going to try to get some sleep. If you see Carpole, tell her we're going through Belport instead of Swinshire."
Stike watched Ibana drill the men the next morning, enjoying the way the horses raced back and forth across the meadow. He waffled between frustration and amusement when volunteers fell from their saddles or dropped their lances, but was definitely annoyed to see Major Gusta and the Riflejacks were showing up the old lancers. They rode out of their camp just after noon with the wind at their backs and the sun high in the sky. Smoke rose in a pillar above some town far to their south, and the road was clear for as far as the eye could see. Stike paused on Amric, looking back toward the place they'd spent the night, and spotted figures in the distance. Curiosity got the better of him, and he removed his looking glass, directing it toward the strangers. They were far enough away that he couldn't make out any details, beyond the fact that there were four of them, and they were on horseback. They weren't wearing Dionysus breastplates or yellow Fatrastan jackets. They sat still, watching as the mad lancers marched down the road, before slowly beginning to follow. Stike briefly considered sending a platoon to run them down, but rejected the idea. He'd either wind up with a slaughtered platoon of lancers or waste everyone's time. The dragonmen weren't going to be seen unless they wanted to be seen. The Dianized bastards, Stike decided, would be harder to lose than he hoped. Troubled, he put away his looking-glass and urged Amrek to catch up with the rest of the lancers. Chapter 23 Mikkel wasn't able to see Yarit until the day after he spotted Fagula meeting with Mahush. Mikkel expected to return to the Capitol building, where he'd met with Yarit in one of the enormous offices upstairs. Instead, Tenek led him to a street a few blocks over from the Capitol building, where a row of townhouse mansions lay within an easy walk of the Engine of Government. The street was full and lively, packed with Dianized dressed in military uniforms and civilian clothing, and it quickly became apparent that the Dianized elite had simply moved into the homes formerly owned by their Fatrastan counterparts. The Yarit household was headquartered in one of the smaller townhouses at the far end of the street. It was a strange sight. Soldiers flanked the front doorway, while a pair of red-headed children played in the narrow garden out front, and restless teenagers loitered on the sidewalk. Tenek scattered the teens with a sharp word, and led Mikkel past the soldiers to the front hall, where Mikkel found a bustling household. Household, it turned out, was an apt word for Yarit's power base. Dianized of all ages filled the halls and rooms. Mikkel, with his limited Dianized vocabulary, overheard conversations involving political strategy, economic speculation, war projections, and plenty of gossip as he was led down the halls and up to a door on the second floor.
"Is this Yarit's family?" Mikkel asked in a low voice as Tenek rapped on the door.
They both looked back down the hall at a pair of 30-somethings sharing a cigarette and openly lambasting a rival family whose name Mikkel hadn't caught.
"Yarit's household," Tenek corrected. "Family has importance in our culture. But household comes first. Everyone in this building is loyal to Yarit through blood, action, or political ties."
"How big is the household?"
"Here? A few hundred, if you don't include active soldiers."
"And back in Dianize?"
"Tens of thousands."
Mikkel let out a low whistle and wondered if every other house on this street had the same flurry of activity. He couldn't voice the question before he heard a muffled sound from inside the room, and Tenek swung the door open. Yarit's office seemed to be the only room in the house with a single occupant. It was a large room constructed in the current Fatrastan fashion, with deep built-in bookshelves, a wide window, and an immense desk. The window was open to allow a southerly breeze, and the desk had been shoved to one side and replaced in the centre of the room with a pair of lounging couches. Yarit stood in front of one of the bookshelves. He spared Mikkel a glance, then removed a book from the shelf and flipped through it for a moment before tossing it on a large pile in the corner.
"I'm amazed at the rubbish you people stack on your shelves just to look intelligent," he commented. "There are histories, encyclopedias, medical texts, sex manuals. Very few of these books have ever been cracked, let alone studied."
"You should see my mother's house," Mikkel said offhand. He immediately bit his tongue, wishing he hadn't said that.
Admitting to a living mother was a piece of information that enemies could use against him. Yarit raised an eyebrow.
"She likes books?"
"Loves them, sir." Mikkel cleared his throat. "Mostly penny novels. She likes adventures."
"Does she read them?"
"Every single one. Many times."
"Then she chooses better books than the fool who owned this library."
Yaret tossed another book on the pile.
I don't keep books unless I intend on reading them. Seems like a waste of money, space, and resources.
He gestured at Tinnick.
You're welcome to look through those and see if there's anything you want for the household library back home.
Thank you, Tinnick said with a nod. He seemed pleased with the allowance, and Mikkel wondered if such an act was a special privilege. At this point, he understood just enough about household dynamics to know how little he actually grasped. Yaret discarded one more book and walked to one of the couches. He lay down, propping his head up with one arm, and examined Mikkel with a sort of idle curiosity that nearly made him squirm. After a few moments, Yaret said,
I understand you have information for me. Have you found the gold rose?
Mikkel cleared his throat, trying to collect the proper words to explain a week of watching a building with nothing to show for it. He decided to tell it straight.
We've been following a man named Marhoosh for a week, he reported.
Marhoosh is the second in command to a gold rose named Valjetura, who I believe has remained in the city.
And you hoped Marhoosh would lead you to this Tura?
Je Tura, Mikkel corrected the vernacular gently. Yeah, that is what we hoped.
And has it?
It hasn't, Mikkel answered. Yaret's eyes flicked to Tinnick with a clear, unspoken question. Mikkel took that as his cue to forge ahead before Yaret could make assumptions about complete failure. Mikkel said,
Marhoosh didn't lead us to Jatura, but he did lead us to someone equally intriguing.
Intriguing or useful? Yaret asked, using the Adran word for both.
Intriguing is the best term, Tinnick said, stepping in. But I think it could be useful.
Well? Yaret asked Mikkel. Mikkel hesitated. In the Black Hats, he would have done his due diligence before such a meeting. He would have found out Forgula's friends and enemies, whom she was useful to, and why. He would have known ahead of time whether her meeting with an enemy of the state was a surprise, a given, or something else. In short, he'd have a pretty good idea how Yaret would react to the news and whether it needed to be sugar-coated or spun. But Dionysus' politics was still an unknown, as was Yaret himself.
We saw Marhoosh meeting with Forgula, Mikkel said. We weren't close enough to overhear the conversation, and Tinnick didn't think we should bring him in for questioning.
Yaret glanced to Tinnick, who gave a small nod.
Well,
Yaret tapped his chin.
One of Sedil's cupbearers meeting with an enemy of the state. That is intriguing.
Yaret paused to sweep his eyes across the half-empty bookshelf on the other side of the room.
You were right not to bring them in.
What do you make of this, Mikkel?
Mikkel was surprised to be asked. This was no longer his territory. He simply didn't know enough about the Dionysus to create an informed opinion. But that wouldn't keep him from trying.
I'm not certain, he began. It's possible that Carsedial has turned Marhoosh and that Forgula is the intermediary. It's also possible that Jatura is negotiating some kind of deal, again with Forgula as the intermediary.
Or?
Yaret asked. The question was a single word, but it held, at least in Mikkel's mind, a world full of menace. How, he wondered, did the Dionysus react to accusations of treason among their own people?
Or, he finally said, Forgula has been turned by the Black Hats.
Forgula is Sedil's creature, through and through, Tinnick said quietly. I don't think she would betray either him or the Emperor.
I agree, Yaret said, sitting up and leaning toward Mikkel. But it's also a possibility that we can't entirely eliminate.
Mikkel found himself nodding along.
Yaret continued, "Kaz Sedyul's household is not supposed to concern themselves with spies and enemy agents. Sedyul oversees the military and the temporary government on the Emperor's behalf. I do not..." Yaret was cut off by a rap on the door. He nodded to Tenik, who opened it, to reveal one of the youths Mikhail had noticed loitering in the hall earlier.
"Pardon, Minister," the girl said, "but Kaz Sedyul is here to see you."
"Nye?" Yaret asked with some surprise.
"He's at the door, sir."
"Send him in." As soon as the door closed, Yaret stood and straightened his pants and jacket, rolling his eyes. "Do you have demons in any of the Cressian religions?" he asked.
"We do," Mikhail answered curiously. Should we go, sir?"
"There's an old saying in Dianais. Speak a demon's name, and he will appear." "No, I'd like you to remain."
Yaret cleared his throat and clasped his hands behind his back, smiling at the door. Tenik took Mikhail by the arm and pulled him to one side just as the door opened. Mikhail had heard more than a few things about Kaz Sedyul's singular meeting with Lindit just before the invasion began. Sedyul was rumored to be an old man, but Mikhail had not expected him to be in his late 70s, wearing a teal cloak over a comfortable-looking maroon tunic. Sedyul walked with a cane, though it was not clear if he actually needed it, and he had a grandfatherly but slightly hawkish face, with sharp eyes and smile lines in the corners of his mouth. If Kaz Sedyul noticed Mikhail and Tenik standing to the side, he did not give any indication.
"My friend," he said warmly to Yaret, taking Yaret's offered hand in both of his.
"Good afternoon, Sedyul," Yaret said in a gentle tone. "I didn't expect your visit. I apologize for the mess."
"Oh, no need. I've been cleaning the bookshelves in my own new home. So much Cressian and Fetchfasten rubbish. It's a pity they wasted so much paper."
The two men shared a laugh as if they were old friends. Mikhail watched the sides of their faces carefully, and despite the warmth of their conversation, he thought he spotted a glint in the eyes of each man.
"My friend," Sedyul said, wiping an imaginary tear from his eye, "I was just passing by, but the truth is that a grave matter has been weighing on me for several days."
Yaret spread his arms. "If there's anything I can do..."
"There is."
Kaz Sedyul's face hardened. The change was almost immediate, like an actor switching masks in the middle of a street performance. The grandfatherly look was gone, replaced by severity chiseled out of marble.
"I want the gold rose."
Mikhail couldn't help but frown. He wasn't certain how much communication went on between the Dionysus ministers and their households, but it made sense that Kaz Sedyul would know about Yaret's quest for Lindit's spies. Did he really micromanage this badly, or was there something more sinister going on? Mikhail saw Yaret's body tense slightly, but Yaret continued as if he had not noticed the change in Kaz Sedyul's expression.
"We're making progress on our search," he said assuringly. "We believe we're looking for a man named Valjatura. Unless..." He paused. "If you're looking for the item we used to open the third floor of the Black Hat archives, I believe the Minister of Artifacts has it now."
"I'm not interested in the artifact," Kaz Sedyul said, "nor this supposed Jatura. I want your pet Black Hat, the one who gave you the rose."
Mikhail heard his own sharp intake of breath and fought to suppress the sudden hammering of his heart. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Tenik glance at him with concern, while Yaret and Sedyul ignored the noise as if he were a piece of furniture. Mikhail barely trusted himself to breathe, waiting for the moment Yaret pointed in his direction and ordered Sedyul's bodyguards to haul Mikhail off.
Mikhail did not know much about Sedil, but Taniel's warnings about the bone eyes still echoed in his mind, and he still had the bruises from Forgula's beating.
"Whatever for?"
Yaret asked curiously.
"Because he's a spy,"
Kaer Sedil replied, as if that were all the reason in the world.
"Yes, I'm aware he's a spy. That's why he's valuable. He's still a spy."
"Ah," Yared seemed to consider this as if it were new information.
"I think I see where the confusion is. You believe he's still working for the enemy."
Kaer Sedil gave the cold smile of someone who knew that Yaret was acting a fool, but could not think of a way to politely break the facade.
"I believe that is the case, yes. Some of my household are concerned that you're giving him too much trust too quickly."
"Oh,
I had no idea that the way I run my household was under scrutiny. I..."
Yaret continued before Kaer Sedil could interject. "If my household is under Imperial review, I would like to know immediately. If it is not, I would like to know why your underlings are watching me. The amount of trust I put in someone I welcomed into my household is entirely up to me." Yaret's voice continued in a gentle manner, but there was a new bite to his words.
"You're not under Imperial review," Kaer Sedil reassured him. "I'm glad to hear that. But I'd like you to consider handing over the Gold Wells for questioning."
"He gave us entry to the Black Hat Library."
"True. But we have no idea what other secrets his head may hold."
Mikhail felt his hackles rise while the two discussed him. He wondered whether Kaer Sedil knew that the man they were discussing was literally in the room. Sedil had given no indication. The thought concerned Mikhail, and he wondered if Yaret had known this conversation was coming, and if so, why Yaret wished him to stay in the room for it. Yaret's genteel facade finally broke.
"I will not hand over a member of my household to be tortured." "He's hardly a member of your household already," Kaer Sedil scoffed.
"He is," Yaret insisted.
"He proved his usefulness when he gave us the millinery library. He is one of dozens of black hats that my people have managed to torn over the last month. Not only is he already the most valuable of those, but he's given me no reason to suspect that he's a double agent. He's actively working with my people to hunt down his former companions."
"And you truly trust him?"
"Truly."
"Trust is a sliding scale, Sedil. He has begun the journey of earning my trust in good faith. I will not break that faith." Kaer Sedil's hardened expression took on an air of annoyance. He was clearly a man used to being given what he asked for. For his own part, Mikhail was shocked that he hadn't been handed over already.
"He need not be tortured," Sedil said.
"I won't give him to the bone eyes either," Yaret said. Mikhail tried not to panic at the idea. Kaer Sedil said,
"You could oversee the questioning. All we have to do is make sure he's spilled all his secrets. If he has, he can return to your household. No harm done."
"You and I have very different definitions of harm," Yaret said quietly. "But I think you already knew that." Kaer Sedil watched Yaret for several moments. His face was still merely stern, but his eyes spoke of a bottled fury.
"Don't let our past disagreements cloud your judgment, my friend.
And don't let your reliance on your sorcery cloud yours," Yaret retorted. He spread his arms. "You control the military and the government. If you try to manage even more, you will run yourself into an early grave. None of us wants that, so I suggest you leave the espionage to me."
Carcedil snorted.
Think on my request, he said before turning toward the door.
He paused halfway through his turn, eyes locking on Mikkel and Tennik, as if noticing their presence for the first time. He gave a slight frown and opened the door. Before he could go, Mikkel spotted a figure standing down the hallway, a striking young woman wearing privileged gloves. She was obviously waiting for Carcedil, greeting him with a nod as he emerged. For some reason, her presence seemed to drive the danger of this situation home to Mikkel. The realization that he could be destroyed by two different sorceries, or any number of mundane ways, made everything just a little more terrifying. The door closed, and Mikkel found himself alone with Yarrat and Tennik again. He glanced between the two of them, his throat dry. No one spoke. After nearly a minute, Mikkel cleared his throat. "Thank you," he said. Yarrat looked up from his own deep thoughts. "Hmm? Thank you for not turning me over to him. I have no desire to be tortured or subjected to sorcery." "Oh, yes." Yarrat waved off the thanks. "You are a member of my household, no matter how early or tenuous. If I make a precedent of handing my people over to a rival household, it'll make it clear to everyone that I am no longer fit to be a minister." Mikkel waited for an ominous follow-up, something like, "Don't make me regret this decision, or betray me, and I will kill you myself." It never came. Instead, Yarrat frowned at the door for a few more moments before saying, "Do you know why I asked you to remain in the room?"
"You wanted to show me that you protect the people who work for you?"
Yarrat gave a genuine chuckle.
"Nothing so serious, though I do make a point of doing so. No, I did it to annoy Sedil. He's a prick, Mikkel, and I don't really give a shit who knows it."
A long, awkward silence filled the room. Mikkel had the sudden realization that he'd just backed the underdog in a struggle he hadn't known was going on. Yarrat might have resources, but Sedil was in charge. This couldn't be good.
"I think he's up to something, sir."
"Sedil is always up to something."
Mikkel tried to piece together the fragments he had gleaned from his week with Tennik. "His underlings are meeting with a Silver Rose in secret. They tried to intercept me when I defected.
Sir, I know it's not my place to say it, but if spying and counter-espionage is your purview, Sedil is definitely making a play for your power."
Yarrat and Tennik shed a long look, and Yarrat gave a sigh.
"You're not saying anything I didn't already know."
"Doesn't he have enough power?" Tennik asked. "He is emperor in all but name."
It's not quite that bad," Yarrat said with a gentle rebuke.
He turned to Mikkel with an apologetic smile.
"I realize you're getting a very swift and possibly dangerous introduction to our world. If you would like to remain with my household but avoid the current scheming, I can send you back to Dainais."
Mikkel was surprised at the offer. He'd never had a superior extend an offer of safety before. Every day was always about what Mikkel could do to further the cause, no matter the danger. Yarrat seemed to have a different respect for human life than Mikkel was used to. Funny enough, safety in Dainais would destroy Mikkel's plans completely.
"I believe I can handle it, sir. I promise to be useful in exchange for hostages. I'm not going to give that up."
"Good,"
Yarrat said, giving Mikkel a tight smile.
"Unfortunately, there are too many tasks and too few people to do them. I don't mind telling you, I need someone with your skills right now."
"Tell me how I can help," Mikkel said.
"The farther I climb,
the better chance I have of getting access to your records,"
he added to himself silently.
"I need you to keep looking for this Jatura, but I also want to know why Fregula is meeting with the Black Hats. Tanik will give you whatever assistance we can spare, including men to follow the Silver Rose."
"I'll get right on it, sir," Mikkel promised.
He waited for a nod of dismissal, then headed toward the door. He stopped with one hand on the knob, turning back.
"Sir, I don't mean to question fortune, but this seems important. Why do you trust me with this already?"
Yarrett chewed on the inside of his cheek, once again looking at the bookshelf he'd been in the midst of cleaning out.
"Like I said, there are too few people to do too many tasks."
Tenek took Mikkel by the elbow and pulled him out into the hall, which had emptied since Sediel's departure. Mikkel scowled at the door as it closed, wondering what he'd gotten himself into.
"He's trusting you," Tenek said quietly, "because he knows having a high-ranking foreigner in his household will annoy the pit out of Khar Sediel."
Mikkel swallowed. He liked Yarrett, but something about his relationship with Sediel was personal. He knew enough about households to realize that if Sediel decided to destroy Yarrett, Mikkel would go down with him. It was not a pleasant thought, and more reason to find Taniel's informant and extractor as quickly as possible.
"Where do you want to start?"
Tenek asked him.
Mikkel thought for a moment. "I'm going to give you a list of Black Hat safe houses. I want them all watched, and I want Marhoosh followed. In the meantime, I need to get closer to Fogula."
"How?"
"I'm not sure. Do the Dianais have social entertainment?"
Tenek raised an eyebrow.
"Something like boxing or horse races. A place where households can intermix."
"We have, well, the best translation is war games. Very popular among all castes."
"And Fogula?"
"She supports one of the players."
"Can you take me to one of these games? I don't need to meet her. I just want to observe her."
"Is tomorrow soon enough?"
Mikkel took a deep breath. He didn't need to just climb the ranks of Yarrett's household. He needed to enter Dainai society. Anything that let him mix with more people would give him a better shot at finding Taniel's informant.
"I'm looking forward to it."
Chapter 24 Laura met Taniel in the hotel great room for breakfast. He sat in the same place as the night before, in the one quiet corner with his back against the wall, sketchbook on his lap, and two plates of egg and hash in front of him. He pushed one over to Vlora without looking up from his sketch. She dropped down across from him and craned her neck. Taniel was drawing the hotel manager.
"Do you remember that discussion we had last night about being circumspect in our mission here?"
he asked quietly. Vlora dug into the eggs and hash.
"Do you remember when I told you not to be a smug prick?"
she replied between bites. Taniel sucked on his teeth and finally looked up. His face was serious, brows knit in worry.
"Sorry," Laura muttered into her meal. "Everyone's been talking about your fight with Jezzy's men," Taniel said. "In here, out there. It's the latest fun bit of gossip. Our only saving grace is apparently there are so many fights every day that people will have forgotten about yours by tonight."
"They tried to recruit me for their club brawl," Flora said defensively, "and they weren't being nice about it. What would you have me do? I didn't take it far enough to give away who I am."
"But it did draw attention."
Taniel nodded across the room to an older woman leaning against the hotel bar.
She had an easy manner, with a quality pistol and sword at her belt, and epaulets on a faux uniform jacket. She was staring at Vlora and Taniel.
"That," Taniel said, "is the Yellow Creek Sheriff. The good news is that she's apparently the only impartial bit of law in this town. And she's given you a pass because Jersey's boys have a habit of coming on too strong. The bad news is she's now going to watch us closely.
Until something else draws her attention." Laura sniffed the tin mug in front of Taniel and found watered wine. She lifted it to the sheriff and downed the rest.
"Hopefully soon," Taniel said.
Laura fetched beer for the two of them, not trusting the water in a place like this, and returned to her seat.
"You're in a mood today," she said. "I spent half the night wandering the town," Taniel said. "I don't sleep much these days."
"Can't?"
"Don't need it."
Laura felt the hair on the back of her neck stand on end, and was reminded that as much as she wanted to think Taniel was still a boy she'd befriended 2 decades ago, he was now something more than human.
And I can't find the damn thing."
Taniel flipped his sketchbook closed in frustration, as if he'd expected to waltz into town and discover the Godstone within hours.
"I can sense it, and that should be enough. Once Pearl knew what we were looking for, she turned me into the same sorcery as the Godstone in Landfall. I should be like a bloodhound to this thing, but instead I'm just walking in circles."
Laura sipped her beer. He did expect to find it immediately.
"Why do you think that is?" "No idea. It's like trying to follow sound in a fog."
He got up and stashed his sketchbook, his eyes focused inward on thoughts he did not share.
"I'm gonna head back out and..."
Taniel was interrupted by the sound of a crash, and the front door of the hotel suddenly burst open. Laura turned to look for the commotion, and her heart fell. It was that asshole Dorna from the night before, and the friend whom she'd dragged down the stairs. Dorna stumbled around the room, clearly drunk, trying to speak with his half-tongue. His companion steadied him and pointed at Laura. The sheriff perked up.
"Boys," she said warningly.
They ignored her and came straight toward Laura. Laura stood up and laid one hand on the pistol in her belt. Neither man had a weapon in hand, but both had swords on them. Taniel stepped between Vlora and the two, barring them both with his arm.
"Can I help you fellas?"
he asked. Dorna stabbed a drunken finger toward Vlora, mumbling something. His companion translated.
"My brother here lost his tongue to this bitch. We're gonna take hers and see if it fits."
"Everyone needs to calm down,"
the sheriff said loudly. She was still ignored.
"I think that's unnecessary," Taniel said. "Let me buy the two of you a few rounds, and we'll talk about some way less violent to solve this whole thing."
"I think that..."
Dorna shoved Taniel hard in the chest, and both men went for their swords. Taniel crashed into Vlora's table, and before either she or the sheriff could respond, his sword was in his hand.
"Calm down before someone gets..."
Taniel began. Dorna leapt forward, sword flashing, his companion on his heels. Taniel thrust once, pivoted, and pushed before either man could take 2 steps. The movement was so quick that Vlora could barely follow it. The two men twitched and tumbled, stuck together by Taniel's sword like chickens on a skewer, dead before they hit the floor. The room was deathly silent, all eyes on Taniel.
"So much for keeping things quiet,"
Laura muttered under her breath. The sheriff approached, pistol in hand, circling the two bodies and leaning over to put her fingers to their necks one at a time.
"Dead,"
she proclaimed. Slowly, Taniel pulled his sword out of the two and faced the sheriff. Vlora could see the fight in his stance, the tension in his legs like a snake coiled to strike. She had no doubt that he could wipe out the whole room before anyone made it to the door, and the thought frightened her.
"Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to disarm yourself," the sheriff said.
"It was self-defense, ma'am," Taniel said.
"I saw that," she replied, "but we're going to have to put it in front of a judge. You need to disarm and come with me."
The sheriff's voice wavered. She could see that same tension in his legs that Vlora could, and she was scared. Vlora waited for him to move. Whatever he did, she would have no choice but to back him up. Things had panned out about as badly as was possible, and she couldn't think of a way to turn it around.
"Tan," she said quietly.
"I know."
Taniel took a deep breath and bent to wipe his sword on Dorna's body before handing it and his pistol to Vlora.
"Get my rifle and pack out of my room," he said to her.
He showed his empty hands and belt to the sheriff and looked down at the bodies, dismayed.
"I guess I am a smug prick, and you're on your own until we can get this sorted out."
The sheriff slowly put up a pistol.
"You two are just a load of trouble, aren't you?"
"Just trying to live our lives, ma'am," Vlora said.
"We'll get this sorted out before a judge," the sheriff repeated. "And then I'll ask you kindly to live those lives somewhere else. Understand?"
Vlora swore to herself, meeting Taniel's gaze. This was going to be a problem, and both of them knew it.
"How long will this take?" Taniel asked.
"Couple weeks," the sheriff sniffed. "We've got just one judge and a damn lot of violence."
Vlora could see in Taniel's eyes that he was reconsidering his offer to go quietly. But the options were slim. Either he could sit in a cell for 2 weeks while Vlora searched on her own, or they could cut their way out through a lot of innocent people and end up being run out of town. She looked meaningfully at the sheriff and nodded.
"So be it," Taniel said coldly.
The sheriff escorted Taniel out of the building, leaving Vlora alone with two corpses and a whole bunch of eyes staring at her. She left the rest of her wine and took Taniel's weapons upstairs, then fetched his pack and stowed it in her own room. She slipped out the back of the building, hoping to avoid any more unwanted attention. Halfway down the street, she stopped and swore to herself, realizing that without that damned magical compass in Taniel's head, she didn't have a chance of finding anything. She muttered and swore to herself and continued on, trying to formulate a plan. She found a secluded street in the girlish quarter and sat down in an alley to try and focus. She closed her eyes and took a deep sniff of powder to enhance her senses and focus her mind. Once she was in a deep trance, she opened her third eye. The world became a hazy, colourless place. Buildings and people seemed almost translucent, and she swept her gaze all around her looking for colour. There was a little of it, small flames like candles burning in windows that she knew belonged to Nacht throughout the city. There were a few dozen of them, which was unsurprising considering the amount of money involved in such a town. Nacht, after all, were useful people. There was nothing else, though. No bright flames of a privileged, and none of the customary pastel smudges that indicated leftover sorcery. She tried to remember what the godstone in Landfall looked like in the Else, and realized that she'd never bothered to check. In the chaos of the battle and subsequent retreat, it had never even crossed her mind. She cursed herself for her foolishness and closed her third eye.
"I can't do this on my own," she said quietly to herself.
She returned to the main street and walked along, eyes on the signs above the storefronts. It wasn't long until she found one that said, "Express Messengers. Your letters, confidential and guaranteed." It was a company that she had seen in Landfall, and she had made use of their services before. She went inside, where a single clerk waited behind a dusty desk, half asleep with his chin resting on his fist. He roused himself as Flora entered.
"Paper?" Flora demanded.
She sat in the corner and penned a letter in Adran military code. She sprinkled the wet ink with black powder and then sealed it in wax with a signet ring she kept in her pocket. It was marked with the old symbol of the Rifle Jacks, a chevron over a powder horn. She gave the letter to the clerk.
"Where to?"
he asked. "That," Flora said, placing several coins on his desk, "might be difficult." She gave the clerk her hotel and room number in case of an answer, and stepped out into the mid-morning air, breathing in the stench. She wanted nothing more than to crawl into a bottle until Olam arrived with the army, but that didn't seem like a very good use of her time. She needed a plan, any plan, that would keep her moving and looking. Without Taniel's sorcerer's compass, she was going to have to depend on footwork. Luckily, she'd already done some thinking on the matter. She would walk each valley and examine each mine, combing the landscape under the pretense of looking for an employer who wasn't the two big boss fools here in town. It would be slow going, and there was a very real risk of attracting attention, but it was the best plan she had. She would look for anything suspicious in this world and in the else.
"Mom?"
Flora was pulled out of her thoughts by a voice at her elbow. She turned and immediately stiffened, her hand falling to her sword arm. There was a paler woman by her side, wearing a duster and tricorn, and the tight pants and loose shirt of a duelist. She was accompanied by seven men and women, most of them paler, all wearing similar outfits and also armed with small swords. Flora ordered them in her mind, body prepared to work through the motions as she cut her way free of imminent violence. The process took a mere seconds, but it was interrupted by a friendly clearing of the woman's throat. She looked at Flora's sword hand.
"No need for that, Mum," she said. "We're here to talk."
"About what?"
"Our boss wants to meet you."
"And who is your boss?"
She thought she had a pretty good idea.
"His name is Bert."
Brown Bear Bert. Jezzy's competition. Flora considered her options. 8-1 were steep odds in a fair fight. She still had a buzz from her earlier sniff of powder, so she could probably take them without too much risk. But if even one was a skilled swordsman, she could be in trouble. Her eyes narrowed as she realized that not one of them was carrying an ounce of powder. Odd that. A coincidence? Or something else? She thought of Taniel sitting in a cell in the Yellow Creek Sheriff's office, and decided that the mission had already taken a big enough hit.
"When?"
she asked.
"Right now, if that's convenient."
Flora took her hand off her sword.
"Then let's get this over with."
The Yellow Creek Picks, as they called themselves, were headquartered at a brothel not more than a few blocks from Flora's own hotel. It was on the edge of the Girlish Quarter, a sprawling, three-story wooden building with an enormous barroom and numerous hallways leading into the bowels of the establishment. Men and women of every nationality and various states of undress circled the room, chatting up the few miners who hadn't yet left to tend to their claims. Whores of both sexes eyed Flora as she walked in, but she was spared the sales pitch and escorted straight upstairs to a spacious room that looked down onto the main floor of the brothel. The centre of the room was taken up by a wide desk on top of the biggest bearskin Vlora had ever seen. The man behind it, despite his name, looked nothing like a bear. Bert was only an inch or so taller than Vlora. He had flaming red hair and